I still do not know if they were fishermen or persons in search of us fugitives. In any case, I could hardly believe that they had not spotted me, for they were within a few yards of me as they ran by. I breathed again, but took this for a warning and remained in my shelter till evening, not moving till darkness had fallen. I followed the Agla the whole night long and made good progress. My next camp provided no excitements, and I was able to refresh myself with a good sleep. Toward evening I grew impatient and broke camp rather too early. I had been walking for only a few hundred yards when I ran into an Indian woman at a water hole. She screamed with fright, let her water jar fall, and ran toward the nearby houses. I was no less frightened than she was and dashed from the track into a gully. Here I had to climb steeply, and though I knew I was going in the right direction, my diversion represented a painful detour that put me back by several hours. I had to climb Nag Tibba, a mountain over 10,000 feet high, which in its upper regions is completely deserted and thickly covered with forest. As I was loping along in the grey of dawn, I found myself facing my first leopard. My heart nearly stopped beating, as I was completely defenseless. My only weapon was a long knife, which the camp blacksmith had made expressly for me. I carried it sheathed in a stick. The leopard sat on a thick branch 15 feet or more above the ground, ready to spring. I thought like lightning what was the best thing to do, then, masking my fear, I walked steadily on my way. Nothing happened, but for a long time I had a peculiar feeling in my back. Up to now I had been following the ridge of Nag Tibba, and now at last I tumbled onto the road again. I had not gone far when I got another surprise. In the middle of the track lay some men, snoring. They were Peter Aufsnater and his three companions. I shook them awake, and we all betook ourselves to a sheltered spot, where we recounted what had befallen us on the trek. We were all in excellent shape and were convinced that we should get through to Tibet. After passing the day in the company of my friends, I found it hard to go on alone in the evening, but I remained true to my resolve. The same night I reached the Ganges. I had been 5 days on the run. At Uttarkashi, the temple town that I have mentioned in connection with my first escape, I had to run for my life. I had just passed a house when two men came out and started running after me. I fled headlong through fields and scrub down to the Ganges and there hid myself between two great blocks of boulders. All was quiet, and it was clear that I had escaped from my pursuers, but only after a longish time did I dare to come out into the bright moonlight. It was a pleasure for me at this stage to travel along a familiar route, and my happiness at such speedy progress made me forget the heavy load I was carrying. It is true that my feet were very sore, but they seemed to recover during my daytime rest. I often slept for 10 hours at a stretch. At length I came to the farmhouse of my Indian friend to whom I had in the previous year entrusted my money and effects. It was now May, and we had agreed that he was to expect me at midnight any day during the month. I purposely did not walk straight into the house, and before doing anything else I hid my rucksack, as betrayal was not beyond the bounds of possibility. The moon shone full upon the farmhouse, so I hid myself in the darkness of the stable and twice softly called my friend's name. The door was flung open, and out rushed my friend, who threw himself on the ground and kissed my feet. Tears of joy flowed down his cheeks. He led me to a room lying apart from the house, in the door of which an enormous key was hanging. Here he lit a pinewood torch and opened a wooden chest. Inside were all my things, carefully sewn up in cotton bags. Deeply touched by his loyalty, I unpacked everything and gave him a reward. You can imagine that I enjoyed the food that he then set before me. I asked him to get me provisions and a woolen blanket before the following night. He promised to do this and in addition made me a present of a pair of hand-woven woolen drawers and a shawl. The next day I slept in a neighboring wood and came in the evening to fetch my things. My friend gave me a hearty meal and accompanied me for a part of my way. He insisted on carrying some of my baggage, undernourished as he was and hardly able to keep pace with me. I soon sent him back and after the friendliest parting found myself alone again. It may have been a little after midnight when I ran into a bear standing on his hind legs in the middle of my path, growling at me. At this point the sound of the swiftly running waters of the Ganges was so loud that we had neither of us heard the other's approach. Pointing my primitive spear at his heart, I backed up step by step so as to keep my eyes fixed on him. Around the first bend of the track, I hurriedly lit a fire, and pulling out a burning stick, I brandished it in front of me and moved forward to meet my enemy. But coming around the corner, I found the road clear and the bear gone. Tibetan peasants later told me that bears are aggressive only by day. At night they are afraid to attack. I had already been on the march for 10 days when I reached the village of Nilung, where last year destiny had wrecked my hopes. This time I was a month earlier, and the village was still uninhabited. But what was my delight to find them my 4 comrades from the camp. They had overtaken me when I was staying with my Indian friend. We took up our quarters in an open house and slept the whole night through. Satala unfortunately had an attack of mountain sickness. He felt wretched and declared himself unequal to further efforts. He decided to return but promised not to surrender till 2 days were up, so as not to endanger our escape. Kop, who in the previous year had penetrated into Tibet by this route in company with the wrestler Kramer, joined me as a partner. It took us 7 long days of marching, however, before we finally reached the pass that forms the frontier between India and Tibet. Our delay was due to a bad miscalculation. After leaving Turpani, a well-known caravan center, we followed the most easterly of 3 valleys but eventually had to admit that we had lost our way. In order to find our bearings, Orf Snater and I climbed to the top of a mountain from which we expected a good view of the country on the other side. From here we saw Tibet for the first time, but were far too tired to enjoy the prospect, and at an altitude of nearly 18,000 feet, we suffered from lack of oxygen. To our great disappointment, we decided that we must return to Turpani. There we found that the pass we were bound for lay almost within a stone's throw. Our error had cost us 3 days and caused us the greatest discouragement. We had to cut our rations and felt the utmost anxiety about our capacity to hold out until we reached the next inhabited place. From Turpani our way sloped gently upward by green pastures, through which one of the baby Ganges streams flowed. This brook, which we had known a week back as a raging, deafening torrent racing down the valley, now wound gently through the grasslands. In a few weeks the whole country would be green, and the numerous camping places, recognizable from their fire-blackened stones, made us picture to ourselves the caravans that cross the passes from India into Tibet in the summer season. A troop of mountain sheep passed in front of us. Light-footed as chamois, they soon vanished from our sight without having noticed us. Alas! Our stomachs regretted them. It would have been grand to see one of them stewing in our cooking pot, thereby giving us a chance, for once, to eat our fill. At the foot of the pass, we camped in India for the last time. Instead of the hearty meat dinner we had been dreaming of, we baked skimpy cakes with the last of our flour mixed with water and laid on hot stones. It was bitterly cold, and our only protection against the icy mountain winds that stormed through the valley was a stone wall. At last on May 17, 1944, we stood at the top of the Tsang Chokla Pass. We knew from our maps that our altitude was 17,200 feet. So here we were on the frontier between India and Tibet, so long the object of our wishful dreams. Here we enjoyed for the first time a sense of security, for we knew that no Englishman could arrest us here. We did not know how the Tibetans would treat us, but as our country was not at war with Tibet, we hoped confidently for a hospitable welcome. On the top of the pass were heaps of stones and prayer flags dedicated to their gods by pious Buddhists. It was very cold, but we took a long rest and considered our situation. We had almost no knowledge of the language and very little money. Above all, we were near starvation and must find human habitation as soon as possible. But as far as we could see, there were only empty mountain heights and deserted valleys. Our maps showed only vaguely the presence of villages in this region. Our final objective, as I have already mentioned, was the Japanese lines, thousands of miles away. The route we planned to follow led first to the holy mountain of Kailas and thence along the course of the Brahmaputra till at last it would bring us to eastern Tibet. Kop, who had been in Tibet the year before and had been expelled from that country, thought that the indications on our maps were reasonably accurate. After a steep descent we reached the course of the Upku and rested there at noon. Overhanging rock walls flanked the valley like a canyon. The valley was absolutely uninhabited, and only a wooden pole showed that men sometimes came there. The other side of the valley consisted of slopes of shale up which we had to climb. It was evening before we reached the plateau, and we bivouacked in icy cold. Our fuel during the last few days had been the branches of thorn bushes, which we found on the slopes. Here there was nothing growing, so we had to use dry cow dung, laboriously collected. Before noon the next day, we reached our first Tibetan village, Kasapling, which consisted of 6 houses. The place appeared to be completely deserted, and when we knocked at the doors, nothing stirred. We then discovered that all the villagers were busy sowing barley in the surrounding fields. Sitting on their haunches, they put each individual grain of seed into the ground with the regularity and speed of machines. We looked at them with feelings that might compare with those of Columbus when he met his first Indians. Would they receive us as friends or foes? For the moment they took no notice of us. The cries of an old woman, looking like a witch, were the only sound we heard. They were not aimed at us, but at the swarms of wild pigeons that swooped down to get at the newly planted grain. Until evening the villagers hardly deigned to bestow a glance on us, so we 4 established our camp near one of the houses, and when at nightfall the people came in from the fields, we tried to trade with them. We offered them money for one of their sheep or goats, but they showed themselves disinclined to trade. As Tibet has no frontier posts, the whole population is brought up to be hostile to foreigners, and there are severe penalties for any Tibetan who sells anything to a foreigner. We were starving and had no choice but to intimidate them. We threatened to take one of their animals by force if they would not freely sell us one, and as none of the 4 of us looked a weakling, this method of argument eventually succeeded. It was pitch dark before they handed to us for a shamelessly high price the oldest billy goat they could put their hands on. We knew we were being blackmailed, but we put up with it, as we wished to win the hospitality of this country. We slaughtered the goat in a stable, and it was not till midnight that we fell to on the half-cooked meat. We spent the next day resting and looking more closely at the houses. These were stone-built with flat roofs on which the fuel was laid out to dry. The Tibetans who live here cannot be compared with those who inhabit the interior, whom we got to know later. The brisk summer caravan traffic with India has spoiled them. We found them dirty, dark-skinned, and shifty-eyed, with no trace of that gaiety for which their race is famous. They went sulkily to their daily work, and one felt that they had settled in this sterile country only in order to earn good money from the caravans for the produce of their land. These 6 houses on the frontier formed, as I later was able to confirm, almost the only village without a monastery. The next morning we left this inhospitable place without hindrance. We were by now fairly well rested, and Kop's Berlin native wit, which during the last few days had suffered an eclipse, had us laughing again. We crossed over fields to go downhill into a little valley. On the way up the opposite slope to the next plateau, we felt the weight of our packs more than ever. This physical fatigue was caused mainly by a reaction to the disappointment that this long-dreamed-of country had up to now caused us. We had to spend the night in an inhospitable sort of depression in the ground, which barely shielded us from the wind. At the very beginning of our journey, we had detailed each member of the party for special duties. Fetching water, lighting fires, and making tea meant hard work. Every evening we emptied our rucksacks in order to use them as footbags against the cold. When that evening I shook mine out, there was a small explosion. My matches had caught fire from friction, a proof of the dryness of the air in the high Tibetan plateau. By the first light of day, we examined the place in which we had camped. We observed that the depression in which we had bivouacked must have been made by the hand of man, as it was quite circular and had perpendicular walls. It had perhaps been originally designed as a trap for wild beasts. Behind us lay the Himalayas with Kemet's perfect snow pyramid, in front, forbidding, mountainous country. We went downhill through a sort of Loess formation and arrived toward noon in the village of Dushang. Again we found very few houses and a reception as inhospitable as at Kasapaling. Peter Orfsnater, in vain, showed off all his knowledge of the language acquired in years of study, and our gesticulations were equally unsuccessful. However, we saw here for the first time a proper Tibetan monastery. Black holes gaped in the loam walls, and on a ridge we saw the ruins of gigantic buildings. Hundreds of monks must have lived here once. Now there were only a few living in a more modern house, but they never showed themselves to us. On the terrace in front of the monastery were ordered lines of red-painted tombstones. Somewhat depressed we returned to our tent, which was for us a little home in the midst of an interesting but oddly hostile world. In Dushang, too, there were, when we came, no officials to whom we might have applied for leave to reside or travel. But this omission was soon to be rectified, for the officials were already on their way to find us. On the next day, we resumed our march with Kopp and myself in front, and Orfsnater and Trippel a little way behind us. Suddenly we heard the tinkling of bells, and two men on ponies rode up and summoned us in the local dialect to return to India by the same way as we had come. We knew that we should not do any good by talking, and so to their surprise we just pushed them aside. Luckily they made no use of their weapons, thinking no doubt that we too were armed. After a few feeble attempts to delay us, they rode away, and we reached without hindrance the next settlement, which we knew was the seat of a local governor. The country through which we passed on this day's march was waterless and empty with no sign of life anywhere. Its central point, the little town of Tsuparang, was inhabited only during winter months, and when we went in search of the governor we learned that he was packing his things for the move to Shangts, his summer residence. We were not a little astonished to find that he was one of the two armed men who had met us on the way and ordered us to go back. His attitude, accordingly, was not welcoming, and we could hardly persuade him to give us a little flour in exchange for medicine. The little medicine chest that I carried in my pack proved our salvation then, and was often to be of good service to us in the future. At length the governor showed us a cave where we could pass the night, telling us once more that we must leave Tibet, using the road by which we had come. We refused to accept his ruling and tried to explain to him that Tibet was a neutral state and ought to offer us asylum. But his mind could not grasp this idea, and he was not competent to make a decision, even if he had understood it. So we proposed to him that we should leave the decision to a high-ranking official, a monk whose official residence was in Thuling, only 5 miles away. Tsuparang was really a curiosity. I had learned from the books I had studied in the camp that the first Catholic mission station in Tibet had been founded here in 1624. The Portuguese Jesuit Antonio de Andrade had formed a Catholic community and is said to have built a church. We searched for traces of it but could not find any remains of a Christian building. Our own experience made us realize how difficult it must have been for Father Antonio to establish his mission here. The next day we marched to Thuling to lay our case before the monk. There we found Orfsnater and Trippel, who had followed a different route. We all visited the abbot of the cloister, who happened to be the official we wanted, but found him deaf to our prayers to be allowed to proceed on our way eastward. He agreed to sell us provisions only if we promised to go back to Shangts, which lay on our road to India. There was nothing to do but agree, as we were without food. There was also a secular official in Thuling, but we found him even less accommodating. He angrily refused all our attempts to approach him and went so far as to arouse the hostility of the people against us. We had to pay a high price for some rancid butter and maggoty meat. A few faggots cost us a rupee. The only pleasant memory that we took with us from Thuling was the picture of the terraced monastery with its gold-pointed roof pinnacles gleaming in the sunlight and the waters of the Sutlej flowing below. This is the largest monastery in West Tibet, but it is a very deserted aspect, and we heard that only 20 out of 260 were actually in residence. When we had finally promised to return to Shanks, they gave us 4 donkeys to carry our baggage. At first we wondered at their letting us go without any guards and only accompanied by the donkey man, but we soon came to the conclusion that in Tibet the simplest method of supervision is to forbid the sale of provisions to strangers unprovided with a permit. The presence of the asses did not add to the pleasure of the journey. It took us a full hour to wade across the Sutlej because the beasts were so tiresome. We continually had to urge them on so as to reach the next village before dark. This place was called Faiwang and had very few inhabitants, but looking up at the hillside we saw, as in Tsuparang, hundreds of caves. We spent the night here. Shanks was a full day's march distant. On our way there the next day, we had the most glorious views of the Himalayas to compensate us in some measure for the barren landscape through which we were driving our donkeys. On this stretch we first met the Kiang, a sort of wild ass, which lives in Central Asia and enchants travelers by the gracefulness of its movements. This animal is about the size of a mule. It often shows curiosity and comes up to look at passers-by, and then turns and trots off in the most elegant manner. The Kiang feeds on grass and is left in peace by the inhabitants. Its only enemy is the wolf. Since I first saw them, these untamed, beautiful beasts have seemed a symbol of freedom. Shanks was another hamlet with only half a dozen houses built of weather-dried mud bricks and cubes of turf. We found the village no more hospitable than the others. Here we met an unfriendly official from Tsuparang, who had moved into his summer quarters. He would on no consideration allow us to proceed any farther into Tibet, but gave us the choice of traveling via Tsuparang or taking the western route over the Shipki Pass into India. Only if we agreed to one of these routes would he consent to sell us provisions. We chose the Shipki route, firstly because it was new country for us, and secondly because we hoped in our hearts to find some way out. For the moment we could buy as much butter, meat, and flour as we wanted. All the same we felt dejected at the unenlivening prospect of landing once more behind the barbed wire. Tripel, who found nothing pleasant about Tibet, was ready to give up and to cease from further attempts to stay in this barren land. We spent the next day mostly in satisfying our appetites. I also brought my diary up to date and attended to my inflamed tendons, which had been caused by my forced night marches. I was determined to take any risk to avoid going back to confinement, and Ofsnator was of my way of thinking. The next morning we got to know the true character of the local governor. We had cooked meat in a copper pot, and Ofsnator must have been slightly poisoned, as he felt very ill. When I asked the governor to allow us to stay a little longer, he showed more ill will than ever. I quarreled with him violently, and to some effect, for he finally consented to supply Ofsnator with a horse to ride as well as putting 2 yaks at our disposal to carry our baggage. This was my first acquaintance with the yak. It is the regular Tibetan beast of burden and can live only in high altitudes. This long-haired species of ox needs a lot of training before you can make use of him. The cows are considerably smaller than the bulls and give excellent milk. The soldier who had accompanied us from Shanks carried a letter for our safe conduct, and this entitled us to buy whatever provisions we needed. It also entitled us to change our yaks without payment at each halting place. The weather by day was pleasant and comparatively warm, but the nights were very cold. We passed a number of villages and inhabited caves, but the people took little notice of us. Our donkey driver, who came from Lhasa, was nice and friendly to us and enjoyed going into the villages and swaggering about. We found the population less mistrustful. No doubt it was the influence of our safe conduct. While we were trekking through the district of Rongchang, we found ourselves following Sven Hedin's route for a few days, and as I was a great admirer of this explorer, lively memories of his descriptions were kindled in my mind. The terrain we traversed remained very much the same. We continued to cross plateau, climb down into deep valleys, and climb painfully up the other side. Often these were so narrow that one could have crawled across them, but it took hours to walk across. These constant ups and downs, which doubled the length of our journey, got on one's nerves, and we thought our own thoughts in silence. Nevertheless, we made progress and had not to bother about our food. At one point, when we had the idea of changing our menu, we tried our luck at fishing. Having had no luck with the hook, we stripped and waded into the clear mountain brooks and tried to catch the fish in our hands. But they seemed to have better things to do than to end up in our cooking pot. So we gradually approached the Himalaya range and sorrowfully the Indian frontier. The temperature had become warmer, as we were no longer so high up. It was just here that the Sutlej breaks its way through the Himalayas. The villages in this region looked like little oases, and around the houses there were actually apricot orchards and vegetable gardens. 11 days from Shanks, we came to the frontier village of Shipki. The date was June 9. We had been wandering about Tibet for more than 3 weeks. We had seen a lot, and we had learned by bitter experience that life in Tibet without a residence permit was not possible. We spent one more night in Tibet, romantically encamped under apricot trees whose fruit unfortunately was not yet ripe. Here I succeeded in buying a donkey for 80 rupees on the pretext that I would need a baggage animal for my things in India. In the interior of Tibet I could never have managed this, but near the frontier it was different and I felt that a baggage animal was absolutely essential to the successful accomplishment of my plans. Our donkey man left us here and took his animals with him. "Perhaps we shall meet again in Lhasa," he said with a smile. He had spoken to us enthusiastically about the pretty girls and good beer to be found in the capital. Our road wound up to the top of the pass, where we reached the frontier, but there were no frontier posts, Tibetan or Indian. Nothing but the usual heaps of stones and prayer flags, and the first sign of civilization in the shape of a milestone that said, similar to 100 miles. We were in India once more, but not one of us had the intention of staying long in this land in which a wire-fenced camp was waiting to receive us. Into Tibet. My plan was to seize the first opportunity to slip over the frontier again into Tibet. We were all of us convinced that the minor officials we had hitherto encountered were simply not competent to decide about our case. This time we had to approach some higher authority. To find what we wanted, we should have to go to Gartok, the capital of Western Tibet, which was the seat of the governor of the region. So we marched down the great, much-used trade road a few miles till we came to the first Indian village. This was Namcha. Here we could stay without arousing suspicion, as we had come from Tibet and not from the plains of India. We passed ourselves off as American soldiers, bought fresh supplies, and slept in the public rest house. Then we separated. Orf Snater and Tripel went down the trade road that flanked the Sutlej, while Kop and I drove our donkey into a valley that ran in a northerly direction toward a pass that led over into Tibet. As we knew from our maps, we had first to go through the Spiti Valley, which was inhabited. I was very glad that Kop had attached himself to me, as he was a clever, practical, and cheerful companion, and his vein of Berlin wit never petered out. For 2 days we tramped upward on the bank of the Spiti River, then we followed one of the nearby valleys, which would clearly bring us over the Himalayas. This region was not well marked on our maps, and we learned from the natives that we had already passed the frontier when we crossed a certain bridge known as Sangsam. During all this part of our journey, we had on the right of us Rewa Fajayul, a beautifully shaped peak more than 22,000 feet high on the crest of the Himalayas. We had reached Tibet at one of the few places where Tibetan territory extends into the Himalaya range. Of course, we now began to be anxious and to wonder how far we should get this time. Luckily, no one knew us here, and no unkind official had warned the people against us. When questioned, we said we were pilgrims bound for the holy mountain of Kailas. The first Tibetan village we reached was called Karik. It consisted of two houses. The next, Dotso, was considerably larger. Here we ran into a number of monks, more than 100 of them, in quest of poplar trunks, which they were going to carry over the pass to Trashigang and the use for one of the monastery buildings. This monastery is the largest in the province of Jurubyan, and the abbot is at the same time the highest secular officer. We began to fear that our journey might come to a premature end when we met this dignitary.